Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Do you want to go to rugby heaven? Let's go back to 1987 with Squidge, with Squidge. Let's go back to 87 with Squidge.
And welcome back at long last to the Squidge Rugby World Cup Retrospective, the rugby podcast that is all about 1987, the current year, what it is right now. Yeah. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
I hope you all enjoyed 1986 as it was last year.
Yeah.
But we, on the other hand, have gone back to Rugby Heaven and 1987.
Yeah, yeah. Or we've gone forward, I suppose, from 1986.
Yeah. Well, hold on. Because it's retrospective. Have we come from 1988?
Oh, that's true, actually. Yeah.
We
need to go backwards, don't we?
Yeah. Like, we've just, like, last year we saw Back to the Future and now we haven't seen it because it hasn't come out yet.
Sure, yeah. Yeah, I was very excited to listen to The Joshua Tree, but then I realised it was already out and now it's not.
It's really disappointing, that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Like, I was really excited about this being the year that Donnie Darko, which won't come out for another 13 years, is set.
Sure.
But alas, it is no longer that year.
Yeah.
Now it's a year that Donnie Darko did not have a plane crash into his house in.
It's gutting, isn't it?
But it's really disappointing.
I'm pretty sure this is the case. I'm just going to just double check.
Mm.
Yes, 1987 was the year Ken Owens was born. So.
Oh, now we're talking.
That's a very good statistic.
Ken Owens is, what, about 6 months older than the Rugby World Cup?
Yeah. His birthday's the 3rd of January, which is also my birthday.
Mm. Robinson's birthday.
Yes.
And Florence Pugh's birthday.
And J.R.R. Tolkien's birthday.
Oh,
yeah.
I think
Mel Gibson's birthday as well.
Okay, don't invite Mel Gibson.
I think...
Cancel culture for you.
Yeah,
Mel
sure.
Mel Gibson not invited to a birthday party with you, Florence Pugh and Ken Owens.
Yeah. And whoever else, J.R.R. Tolkien.
J.R.R. Tolkien.
Yeah. I think we'll have a well. If you put J.R.R. Tolkien and Ken Owens in a room, what would they talk about?
Genuinely nothing.
Because it'd be like, oh yeah, here's all this cool fantasy shit I'm on about. And then Ken would just be like, yeah, I want to talk about tractors, you idiot.
I'll tell you what they talk about, the Welsh language.
That's true, actually.
Because Tolkien was an obsessive linguist.
Yeah.
And Ken is an obsessive Welshman.
So
they would just talk about the Welsh language for ages.
So I've seen this advert on Channel 4, and it's the most Channel 4 thing you'll ever see. This program, which is a dating show for people who don't speak the same language, but they don't know that until they've applied for it, until they're on the show. Right. And then they tell them that none of you speak the same language.
It's
hosted by Davina McCall, which is the most Channel 4 thing you could possibly imagine. I reckon that's what it would be like, that Ken would just immediately start firing off in Welsh to Tolkien, who would eventually just kind of go like, you know what? I'm going to learn my way around this and try and understand this fella. Because I reckon he's like, maybe, I don't know what language he's speaking, but I reckon that country, he's their all-time most capped hooker.
I think Tolkien spoke Welsh.
You reckon?
I think he did. Because he spoke like 14 languages or something.
Sure.
And made up his own.
Okay, yeah.
Nerd.
Yeah.
I was in my first year of uni, we had one lecture where the lecturer ran through everything in like half an hour. And then went, so this is a lot to be 4 hours. So either you can go home now, or I can do the rest of the lecture on J.R.R. Tolkien. And because I was on a course with a bunch of nerds, they all voted to listen to Tolkien.
Really?
And, yep. And,
wow.
And I think, so I sat and I listened for 3 hours to a man talk about Tolkien.
Wow.
And that is the only lecture where I fell asleep.
That's impressive.
I genuinely just fell asleep in my chair. And
how many people were in the room? Was it a big lecture theatre or was it like a smaller seminar?
My course only had about 30 people on it.
Okay.
So it was probably like high 20s, like 26, 27.
You only fell asleep once in a lecture?
As far as I recall, I don't know.
I suppose you don't really remember sleep.
No, I did
you?
Actually. I fell asleep. I did a module of film studies, and I fell asleep watching Lawrence of Arabia.
Okay, fair enough.
Which is 4 hours.
I think I fell asleep 3 or 4 times in uni. One of them, I was sat. It was in a room with about 6 people in it. I was sat directly opposite the lecturer, and one other person noticed that I fell asleep. It was for about 3 seconds. I fell asleep.
Right.
And immediately woke back up, but. Yeah, that was a scare.
I was asleep for about 15 minutes.
Oh, okay, yeah. I've never fallen asleep for that long.
Phasing out, I didn't have one of those moments where you kind of like nod off and wake up.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, okay, I've never, you know what? Cumulatively, you've probably slept for longer in your lectures than I have.
Yeah.
Even though I will have fallen asleep a lot more times.
No, I did that where I kind of phased out quite a lot.
Yeah.
I don't really sleep generally ever. Sure. I never really have.
Yeah.
But yeah, over... In a lecture, I once fell asleep properly.
Yeah,
which is maybe
yeah.
the only time I've ever fallen asleep with all the lights on around people.
Yeah.
You know, in a room of 30 people.
Yeah. It's interesting that, isn't it? How easy it is to fall asleep in lectures. I don't know if just the background noise really helps.
Bloody ones about Tolkien it is.
Yeah, that's true. We always had it with... Because to my shame, I had to do... Because I did an English language degree, but the university I went to, which was Derby, the same uni you went to, at the time didn't run an English language degree on its own. And I just kind of did that because that was the one thing I was fine at A-level. Just kind of like blitzed through that. But they didn't run that on its own, so I had to do an English literature degree as a kind of like semi-joint honours thing. And the amount of times in literature the lecturers had to remind people that they're not allowed to do Harry Potter... was insane.
Oh, yeah, I mean...
There were Northampton Saints fans, not Tigers fans.
We'll move on in a moment, but I'll tell one final anecdote. There was one... Because, again, Michael said a lot of people loved Harry Potter and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
There was one lecturer who I had who was the most
was a
softly spoken man.
Yeah.
Yeah. He was the most softly spoken man I've ever met in my life.
Okay.
He was like, if poetry about rain was a person, it would be him. He just wore cardigans. His name was Adrian. He was wonderful and lovely. But again, spoke like this and did poetry lectures and talked about how lovely pollen is in May. And that was Adrian. And then one person who was really into, I think it was Dostoevsky or, you know,
one of the big nerds.
Yeah. Kafka. Actually, I think it might have been Kafka. It might have been
big fucking nerds. That's who they are.
And he said, you should really go and do something in the style of...
This nerd.
Dostoevsky, you know, it was that kind of thing. He was really encouraging him. He said, because I'm really... No, I want you to do something so we can show it to all these Harry Potter-loving cunts.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And he just dropped that on someone.
Yeah, I love that. That's a really good,
really,
powerful
really
use of swearing.
People who got into... everything through Harry Potter.
Yeah, that's brilliant. Well, I mean, that's actually a really good segue because you mentioned that the pollen is nice in May. And that's when this game took place, in May 1987, the 24th, to be precise. The current year. This happened in the future, maybe?
Yes, we are.
Because Ken Owens was born 9 days ago as we record this.
To now talk about Japan against the United States. Both countries' first ever Rugby World Cup match.
Hell yeah.
Two teams who, if you listen to certain sections of world rugby, are going to win the World Cup in future. This is where it all began for them.
Yeah. It's pretty impressive watching this game back and kind of thinking like... So the commentators and the pundits beforehand summed up America as being overwhelming favourites.
No.
They said that America are the much bigger rugby nation and Japan are sort of the underdogs. But then they said, but every time they played before, they'd played twice before this.
Mm.
One of them was 9-all. One of them was 15-16 to the USA. So they recognised that there was some potential for Japan. But the issue with these pundits was they clearly hadn't seen these teams play before.
So, yeah, I'm a huge fan of this. That whereas nowadays you get a lot of punditry on World Cup matches where they clearly haven't watched Uruguay or Russia before. And they don't
even though they have the resources to do so.
Oh, yeah. But they try and, like, bluff it. And trying, like, Clive Woodward claiming that Canada have a big ice hockey background in a lot of their players.
Yeah.
When literally one of their players has an ice hockey background.
Yeah. It's just racial stereotyping.
I really appreciate
the Canadian front row is quite good and big and strong because they have lots of maple syrup over there.
Yeah, they're just constantly downing it. Whereas I quite appreciate the fact that these pundits were very upfront about the fact they don't know who any
players are. Yeah. No, I do massively respect
and
that.
All three, the presenter and both pundits, and we'll get onto the pundits in a moment, all refer to both teams as an unknown quantity. Yes. They don't know anything about
it's
these
really
players.
Good that cliche exists, isn't it?
Yeah.
That the phrase unknown quantity, because it makes you sound smart while saying I don't have a fucking clue what I'm on about, which is very, very good. And I mean, the king of that is Murray Mekstad, who was on the punditry on this, and it was great because he was simultaneously going, oh yeah, I don't really know these players, and he was just kind of spouting catchphrases to kind of go like, oh well, America, they probably play fine, you know, Japan, if their support play is good, they'll be grand because they play nice patterns.
So there were two pundits here, right? Yeah, one of them is Murray Mekstad, looking the most 1987 any man has ever looked.
Yes,
he had an enormous mustache and a mullet, like a mullet that looks fictional. It looks drawn on, like with crayon. After someone's literally come up to my screen and scribbled it on his head.
Yeah.
And then the other pundit, who seems to be a comedy character played by Taika Waititi.
Yes,
it's his name. But he looks like Taika Waititi.
You are spot on with the comedy mustache.
Like, yeah, he's got a comedy mustache, like in bloody Jojo Rabbit, and he's doing the Korg voice. He's doing the Korg voice from Thor Ragnarok. And so it's always just like, yeah, thanks, guys. I think that Japan will look to improve at the set piece. I couldn't get it out of my head.
Yeah.
We're watching Korg as a pundit.
My favourite quote from Murray Mekstad in this game, before the game started, he says, I think the Americans will play with American enthusiasm.
I also wrote that down.
I think that is on a par with Eddie Jones's, they're going to come out like 15 Donald Trumps.
But it's even less because he's saying literally nothing.
Yeah, I know. It's great because, like, I accept that Murray Mekstad and his power of punditry is fine at this stage when watching 1987. I'm actually on board with it at this stage. Whereas a lot of people criticise it because, like, let's be honest, the more recent stuff is, like, it's laughable because you expect something serious nowadays. But honestly, I'm so down for it when watching this game back.
Absolutely, absolutely. And as I say, like, they are limited to basically having watched when these teams have toured.
The resources
are
very...
the only reference points they've
little.
Had.
Yeah. So I don't blame them for not knowing what they're on about, like...
No, exactly. So it's quite a difficult thing.
Yeah.
And they do mention as well, the last time Japan played New Zealand, because their team was so physically small, they'd only been offered games against students and age and like the New Zealand under 20s sides. They hadn't been offered a game against the All Blacks, even though it was a touring national team.
That's crazy. That's crazy. I mean, should we talk about Japan and their team and everything?
Yeah, let's run through the
because
teams a bit.
Because with Japan, I can kind of look at their style of play at this point and go, I can see how that develops into what they are in 2011.
Yes.
Not anything beyond that, because that's a complete overhaul from Eddie Jones and Jamie Joseph. But,
but
I can see how that translates.
There is still DNA that leads to this.
100%.
So, and I mean, I guess we'll get into this in more detail.
Yeah.
But I've really enjoyed watching Japan because their entire... They are the team that I think so far out of this World Cup has had the clearest game plan. Like, they have philosophy on how they want
to play.
And whereas the others have sort of just played on vibes, other than Italy, who just booted literally everything. Japan, their game plan is offload until we knock it off.
Exactly. And usually that's about two offloads. But you occasionally get those passages of play where they string together like eight and you go, oh my God, they're incredible. But usually, like 90% of the time, they just throw one and they drop the ball.
But sometimes you say it really comes off.
Yeah, and it looks beautiful when it does.
It does. It looks stunning quite regularly and they rarely make more than 10 metres from
it.
But they are on about 1 metre per offload.
But they're very entertaining, aren't they? So looking at the team, they have their captain Toshiyuki Hayashi playing in the second row, who was quite fun. He clearly fancied himself quite a lot and clearly was knocking on the coach's door quite a lot asking for the captaincy, but I liked him.
Can we take a moment to talk about Hayashi?
Yeah, go on.
Before we move on. So Hayashi, obviously the captain.
Yes.
And he runs out and he wears this bright scrum cap, like very eye-catching scrum cap.
Yeah, yeah.
But he also has, in his mouth, he has something in his mouth for all time.
Is it a mouth guard?
Not a mouth guard. No. And I was just looking at it. I was trying to work out what it was the whole time because it looks like he's got like a dummy in his mouth because there's a string coming out.
Okay.
And what he seems to be doing is, you know, the little strap from the bottom of his mouth guard? Like, he's got one he has to physically, like, tie a knot in, rather than having, like, the Velcro strap along.
I tend not to tie a knot in my mouth guard.
The scum cap. Yeah, so he's got, like, a thing he's had to tie a knot around on his
shirt.
Okay. And what he's doing the whole game, every time we see him, he's doing this. He's brought the end of it up, instead of leaving it dangling below his neck or under his chin. He's bringing it up and he's putting it in his mouth.
He's chewing it.
So he's playing, chewing on the knot from his, like...
That's so weird, but I love it.
His scrum cap.
I love it.
And, like, there's a point where he's talking to the referee and he's still got it in his mouth.
That's incredible. I think, we're about, what, 5 games into this 1987 tournament? We can nearly put together a full, like, 15 of players who've had kit malfunctions. Yeah. Like, there was the Romanian lad who carries tape in his pocket at all times, even during the match. Like, there's plenty of people who've had tape malfunctions left, right and centre, but that's incredible. I did not notice that once, but I really hope he continues to do that throughout the tournament, because I love that.
It was really bothering me just seeing something in his mouth, so I had to pause it and go, like, what is that?
Yeah.
And I'm pretty sure that's what it was, unless he brought, like, as I said, like a dummy.
That's phenomenal.
Like a pacifier, as the Americans
might
call it.
That's so good. So they have a hooker called Tsuyoshi Fujita, who was misspelled on the team sheet as Fuoita, which, so I wrote that down on my team sheet and then realised the commentators were calling him Fujita and thought that makes a lot more sense. But he was constantly praised by the commentators, like, this is a world class player, like, he's Japan's, like, most talented lad. And to be fair, he did kind of seem the spit of Shota Horie.
He is good.
Yeah.
Like, it's notable. He is, I think, if we're picking a team of the tournament so far.
Yeah, based on the first round.
Brian Moore.
Yeah.
For the hooker who looks the most like an actual rugby
player. And it's not like he was nails or anything. He was just, like, he knew how to ball. He could catch, pass, offload.
There's a moment in the first half, towards the end of the first half, where he, and his line-out throwing technique I really enjoyed, which was basically he would absolutely pelt it at whatever the target was. Like, as hard as he could. And they're clearly, the call is to throw to the front. So, seeing as that guy is stood like 2 meters,
he throws it like a shot put, doesn't he?
He does. He has it in one hand, he just lobs
it.
You can't see the gesture I'm doing. But it is, it's like a shot put style.
Like low and hard.
Straight, like NFL, but low. Like, you know, he's not floating it in the air or anything.
No.
So he pelts it straight at the guy right in front of him, who has a hand up, but obviously doesn't have the reaction times to catch it. So it bounces off his teammate at the front of the line out, onto the floor, at which point he puts the most beautiful touch, like a really great, like, football, soccer, first touch through to dribble it past his opposite number. He then dribbles it round the scrum half who's covering
and
back.
The winger.
And and, like, it's really good, like, technical,
it's beautiful
skill.
Yeah, really good footwork.
Like, he knows what he's doing in terms of,
and it's
that's
it. It's intelligent, like stabbing it in, it's like into a position where the scrum half and the winger won't expect him to, and he very nearly scores from that, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's just the scrum half gets there ever so slightly before Mike Saunders, the USA scrum half, narrowly beats him to the ball, but it's properly both of them are diving forward at the same time. Like, if he was any quicker, if that was a back, he'd have scored.
So, absolutely. Look at the Japanese back line quickly. So, Seiji Hirao playing at 10, who was quite fun.
So, Seiji Hirao played at the time. He'd just come back to Japan to prepare for the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
But he played for a few seasons for Richmond in England.
Oh, yeah, they did say that, didn't they?
So, yeah, which I think is quite exciting.
Yeah, yeah. I'd love to see how he played in the English leagues, actually, because, like, he basically just didn't kick the ball or anything. He would mainly just try and step around everybody. He was basically a winger trapped in a tense body, wasn't he?
Yeah.
I really enjoyed Seiji Hirao. But their wingers, I think, are quite notable, because they've got, on one wing, they've got Nofomuli Tawamuli Falau, who was clearly quite this good sort of technical winger, would try and duck around people, you know, and would just run straight. And then on the other wing, they had Shinji Anuki, who was just a party man. Like, he was great. He was just, every time he got the ball, he would mainly run sideways, but it would, with the most beautiful footwork you'll ever see. And it was properly like Shane Williams-esque feats that he was showing. And I really enjoyed the battle him and his opposite winger Purcell had together, because they were constantly going at each other, and I loved it.
He also had a really great nose for when to stab a grubber in behind. Like, every time he did it, it seemed like the perfect option. Space, or there's once right towards the end of the game.
Sure.
Where he stabs it through straight, so low and hard at Purcell, who knocks it on, dives on it, and rolls into touch.
Yes. I noticed that exact one you're on about, where he knocks it on and rolls into touch, and then Anuki just sits on him. which I think is really funny.
What a guy.
Should we look at the USA team quickly?
Yeah, I want to mention as well, Harrow had come in, he was Richmond's big signing the previous season after they got relegated. Was the equivalent of the championship.
Sure.
They were quite a big team at the time. Mm-hmm. They were kind of the up and down side. They were promoted the following season when he left. So yeah, Richmond were like, it's not like now where they're kind of like bottom end of the championship.
Yeah, yeah.
They were a big team at the time.
Right, okay.
And so he's the equivalent of a player playing in the Premiership.
Sure. Okay.
So he's their
big player, yeah.
Yeah.
At this stage. Okay. So yeah, the USA team, let's look at them. So they have a front row of some of the most American names you could ever imagine.
Oh.
Rick Bailey at loosehead prop, John Everett at hooker, and Fred Paoli at tight head, which is quite. Also, in the second row, they have Kevin Swords and Ed Burlingham.
I was going to say, it keeps going for the entire back. Kevin Swords, Ed Burlingham, Dr. Gary Lambert, who's a chiropractor, Blaine Warhurst.
He's not real.
And then Brian Vizard, like Lizard with a V.
It is a pack full of great names. I hadn't heard of any of these players, any of the players on the pitch, I will add, before watching this game. But it was particularly notable looking on the team sheet and seeing Jay Clarkson playing at 10.
Yes, yeah, I heard that. It is, of course, Joe Clarkson, the father of...
Yeah, Jeremy's dad. No. But yeah, then they had Kevin Higgins playing outside centre, was quite fun.
Mate,
and Ray Nelson at fullback, who I quite liked.
I'm going to talk so much about Kevin Higgins. Then, yeah, Ray Nelson, who, first time we see him is from a certain angle, and he's got kind of quite long hair, and he's got like a certain... like posture about him.
Sure.
And I did think he looks a little bit like Friend of the Pod and Incredible Illustrator Matt McKnight.
Yes, yes.
And then you see him up close and he doesn't so much, there's a slight resemblance.
He's from the US of A, isn't he? So there could be some relation. It's not like the USA is a massive place
there's only one family in the
USA. Yeah. Hello Matt, if you're listening.
Look, we're from our family all date back through the same one village in Wales, going back generations. I know we're inbred, so I assume that literally everyone else is.
We literally had a conversation about this yesterday, didn't we? About whether or not we're related to somebody that we were raised to call our auntie.
Yeah.
But chances are we probably are because we're from Wales.
Yeah, look, if we're not related to Auntie Doris, we're definitely related to Auntie Doris.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Should we come on to the game? Or just before the game, Japan stood normally for the national anthem.
It's the first time in the history of the Rugby World Cup where the teams line up for the anthem.
Yeah.
And then the USA obviously squander it by going into a huddle to really awkwardly sing it.
Yeah.
To which the commentators say, well, they won't be challenging the Welsh for their singing anymore.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Going like, but Welsh haven't played yet. Why are they? And everyone's like, oh no, it's just a stereotype.
Yeah, that's where we're at. Of course. I enjoy it. So the very first kickoff of the game, the referee rules it not 10, even though it literally does go 10 before the ball is played. But
it only just goes 10. But
Yeah.
So the first scrum comes, right? And before the game, there was a lot of talk about how the USA team is so much physically bigger than the Japanese team. They don't bring up pack weights or anything at this point.
Yeah.
You know, there's no way of necessarily knowing that. But the USA have a far physically bigger team. And directly before the scrum, the commentator says something like, you know, well, obviously we know how this is going to go. It'll be fascinating to see the scrum because the USA is so much bigger and they should just blow them off the ball. And Ed Burlingham, the USA captain, the second row, had also said like their game plan was very much to just blow Japan off the ball, which is just to be incredibly physical and dominate.
Be stronger than
because
them.
Because they
have
a physically bigger team.
Yeah.
And so the first scrum happens and Japan drive them backwards like 7 or 8 metres.
And that's because they invent getting lower than the opposition.
Yeah.
And the commentators are blown away by this as well.
It's proper, like, power of technique and body position.
Yeah.
Like, they drive them backwards off the ball. And the USA do get wise to it a few times and just use their big lads and make sure you don't shift them.
Yeah.
But it's a really incredible thing to watch Japan kind of shoving as an eight rather than as eight individuals.
Yeah. It is interesting because they have a few moments. There is actually a really nice kind of contrast between these two teams' approaches to the set piece, isn't there? Because there's a point where Japan do a dummy jumper in a non-lifting line-out, I think it's the first line-out of the game. And it's just like, what's the point of doing a dummy jumper? We can literally see the ball coming in. But I guess it makes sense when they've got Fujita lobbing it in like a grenade.
Yeah. There is also, it's notable how much shorter the Japanese locks are than their equivalent.
Yes.
So Hirashi was their tallest player, and he was 6 foot tall.
Right, okay, yeah, that makes sense. Did you notice something very notable about the USA lineup throughout the game? You could always hear the hooker Everett shouting the lineup calls on the ref mic throughout the game. Did you clock their lineout calls?
No.
I cracked their lineout calls on the second lineout. Yes.
Go on.
So, for example, the one where I noted it was he shouted, Blue, 3-1-1.
Okay.
The first number he shouts is where he's throwing it to. So if he shouts Blue, 3-1-1, he's throwing it to 3.
Okay. As in the third person back.
Yes. Yeah. And throughout the game, that was it. He would just shout a bunch of words, including some numbers. The first number he said was where he was throwing the ball. And he would just shout in front of the opposition. I have, retrospectively, 40 years on, crack this line-out call.
Or at Victor Matfield.
Yeah. Look, I've taken my time over it. But literally on the second line-out, I realised this is what's happening. And I kept wanting to validate it by listening to him and thinking, I really hope I've got it wrong, because it's quite easy to crack. But no, every time. And I kept listening to it and thinking, have I got this right? Yeah, it's gone exactly where I expected.
This might work against Japan, a country of a completely different language that shares nothing with English.
That's true, actually, yeah.
But their next two games are against Australia and England.
Yeah, I think England might get that. Australia, I mean, they had a good line out from what I can recall in the game we watched. So I feel like that's going to be a bloodbath.
But the thing is, like, Japan, their pack was so short they struggled at the line out anyway. Yeah. And it's always a lottery in this era before lifting. But particularly so when your tallest player is 6'1".
Sure. Yeah. I remember thinking about it. When I played junior rugby, when I was like under 14s, our line-out calls were just the letters from FRONT, front, MIDLE, middle, and BACK, back.
Right.
And that was literally it. Just any word starting with those letters is where we were going. And thinking about it, like, it never got cracked, even though it was just the simplest line-out call you could do other than Blue 3-1-1. And that's where we're throwing it. Or just telling the opposition, yeah, we're going to go to that guy. Yeah. But yeah, no, it's just while we're thinking about complicated lineout calls, I just thought I'd share that incredibly enthralling story.
No, thank you. I was incredibly enthralled. So Japan break away off that first scrum.
Yeah.
And charge down the pitch.
Yeah.
And they go for a drop goal right away.
Yeah, that's fun, isn't it?
I love them setting up for the drop goal, and it's charged down.
Yeah.
Only because there was an offside and the USA penalised for it.
They were very committed to going for that drop goal as well. So I like the point where there's one of the players had open field in front of them and gives a hospital pass because they really want to commit to setting this drop goal on second phase.
Look, that's what I want out of a rugby team.
Absolutely.
That's like, I've talked about this before, but Rugby Union Manager 3 having a setting where your team will automatically go for drop goals
if
you're within range. I want that turned on for teams at the World Cup other than Namibia in 2011.
Especially if you can, yes. Especially if you can define range.
Yes, exactly. And so Japan, look, they decide to take the penalty. They decide to take the 3 points from the penalty.
Yeah.
They line it up and they nail a kick from straight between the posts, which we learn is not something you should take for granted with this team.
Absolutely. So Japan take a 3-0 lead, don't they?
Yeah. Kojihiro Yoshinada is the goal kicker, the 12.
Yeah.
He's the guy kicking for them. But he also is
base 13.
He was... Yeah, so he was at 13, but I think, does he go off? Because the second half it was saying...
No, he just missed 6 kicks in a row, so they changed the kicker.
That's fair enough.
Which isn't even the most kicks someone's missed in a game in this World Cup far.
We'll get onto that, but it doesn't go well for them.
Yeah. But on the other end of the spectrum, when the USA first get a shot at goal, right in the corner on the 22, Ray Nelson steps up. And he absolutely bloody nails it. Like, the touch judge comes on to bring it, to offer him sand, which is a mental thing in itself. That is the touch judge in his full kit saying, do you want this sand? We've got some on the sideline. And he says, no, just going to put it on the floor. And he absolutely nails it from the touchline. It's a great kick.
Can you imagine that nowadays? Can you imagine Matt Carley coming on for Bucket?
Yeah, right? But no, Nelson kicks brilliantly. Spade. Like, from the touchline, nails it over, and it's 3-3. The commentator also says, Ray Nelson, he's a veteran with 5 tests to his name.
Yes. Do you want some hot Ray Nelson facts?
Yeah, go on.
So Ray Nelson was born in Glasgow.
Yes, I did clock this. So I also looked him up and I thought, okay, He couldn't get into the team for Gavin Hastings, could he?
No, exactly. So he was just outright Scottish.
But he was good,
there
man.
There is no word on what his link to the US is. I've tried to look this up. He is just a Scottish man who decided he was American
because
and nobody
called
questioned
Ray.
It. Nobody asked, so how are you American? He went on to score 28 points for the US, which stood as a record until 2003.
Did Mike Kirkus take that from him?
Mike Kirkus took that from
him. Yes, what a guy. Do you want to know another hot Ray Nelson fact?
Mm.
This game, this particular game we're on about today, USA against Japan, Ray Nelson played that well that he got a positive Ruddy Data video made from about it.
No way!
Yeah.
And
that's
no
the,
way.
That's
it's
the first time we've had to address
Tyler
one of those.
Ardron against Munster.
Yeah, yeah,
those
yeah.
Those the only two positive Ruddy Data videos.
Yes, but you know what else that means? That means Ruddy Data's done the exact same thing as us. And has gone
and
through the whole 1987 World Cup. So
no,
he can
watched.
Find this.
He's probably just watched the USA, hasn't he? Because he was like, huh, Rick Bailey. He sounds like he might do six knock-ons.
That's true. He sounds shit. They had a player called Joe Clarkson. I could make a joke about him being like Jeremy Clarkson. But yeah, Ray Nelson gets a positive Ruddy Data review after this game, which
That's
is more than
impressive.
Rem Nagar ever did.
Yes. By a long, long way. Yeah, I mean, I think... So, Ray Nelson, can we talk about him for a moment?
Yeah.
Because I think... Ray Nelson obviously gets a positive Ruddy Data video out of this, but I think he could also find a negative Ruddy Data video out of this. Because Ray Nelson is... I remember... I don't know if anyone remembers End Games or Hypersport, who was a Kiwi rugby YouTuber.
I do remember him.
Sort of around
yeah.
27.
He was great. I really like him.
He was great. He was great. I spoke to him once over Skype.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was... He
He's
like
the
a
sort of
guy,
if he was still going, we'd have him on as a guest on this podcast.
Absolutely. Then he disappeared off the face of the earth, and I wonder where he is. And if he isn't, if he is listening, please get in touch.
Or if anyone knows where he is, we would definitely have him on this podcast.
He used to have a thing that he described Liam Williams as being, every time he got the ball, either the best player in the world or the worst player in the world, right? And I think that actually is closer to Ray Nelson.
Sure, he has
so
his moments.
Ray Nelson is... You know the kind of the thing about Star Trek movies? Like the cliche
thing
is
about
that...
Them.
The cliche about Star Trek movies is the even-numbered ones are shit and the odd-numbered ones are good.
Okay, okay.
Right, so like Star Trek 1 is good, Star Trek 3 is good, but Star Trek 2 and 4 are shit.
Okay,
that
yeah.
kind of thing. That's kind of the general pattern that yeah. is always the thing. I think Ray Nelson's like that, that every other touch he's incredible. And then the touch in between, he'll knock it on, or he does like, he shanks like six kicks.
Yeah, he does, he does. Occasionally he'll do a beautiful spiral that's like a 50-22. Yeah. And then there's one where he catches the ball, realises that there's a winger in front of him, shits himself and just grubbers it into touch backwards.
That's my favourite one. That's,
that's
my favourite,
favourite
one.
Bit of the game.
Because he like regathers the ball perfectly in like modern fashion, like keeps
yeah,
the ball
yeah.
in, covers it really well. And then looks up and sees there's someone chasing, so he grubbers the ball in, like, into touch, like a metre in front of
like,
him.
He could have just ran into touch.
Yeah.
But he just decided
he
literally he could not be bothered to run with the ball, so he just grubbers
he
it out.
He would have made more ground if he ran into touch.
Yeah. Yeah.
But instead, he grubbers it to the spot right in front of him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, he could have tried to go on the outside of this guy and get driven out. That's not great,
yeah.
but it's acceptable.
It's
because
like...
he tries.
In football, when, you know, a team is defending and they'll deliberately put the ball into touch.
Yeah, yeah. If in doubt, kick it out.
Yeah. And I think there is something that I thought during this game, that there is something closer to football in that it was harder to control possession at this era.
Sure, yeah.
Like, it is far harder to keep hold of the ball for long passages.
Yeah, definitely.
You couldn't have done a 40-phase move.
Definitely.
Obviously, they're difficult to do nowadays, but they're possible. Whereas
yeah.
that was not possible, especially because the referee blows up at any ruck.
Yes.
And just awards a scrum.
Just explodes, yeah. No, yeah, I completely agree with that. Like, there's at some point, somebody's going to throw a bad pass, or
yeah.
anything goes at ruck time so you can lose something. There's a point I've got written down here where Saunders does a dive pass into touch, which I think is particularly entertaining. Can we talk about Japan's fun tap move that
go
they
on.
Run early on? Where they get a penalty in the USA 22,
oh, yes.
and they run it with the fly half, runs a loop around the hooker, and then a double scissors. And unfortunately, the guy he actually pops it to on the scissors drops the ball.
Yeah.
But it was really fun to watch that, because that's one of the things that I would like to come back into rugby one day, is
yes.
just ridiculous tap moves.
And I think Hirao is maybe the most talented in a modern sense player I've seen so far.
Sure.
Like, he reads a defence so well. He does. Not necessarily the game, but he reads a defence phenomenally well.
I think that's an entirely valid point.
There's something of like... It's like you dumped 30% of George Ford into the 1987 World Cup. Like, he times a pass beautifully.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of other players we've seen in this World Cup where you would talk about the passing being great, you're doing it because they're technically good passers, you know?
Yeah. And he doesn't like kick needlessly or anything like that, does he? I think he's actually quite composed in, like, not necessarily in a kind of Johnny Wilkinson manner, but more in like a Kosuke Ono kind of a manner, you know?
Sure, yeah. He just, like, he is very good at holding his nerve and waiting until the time is right.
Yes.
And there's a moment not long after this, and I don't know if we want to lead on to the Japan's first try.
Yeah, we can do.
Comes from him, just that move. There's a few times in the lead-up where he does this as well, where he, like, feints on a pass, waits to draw someone imperfectly, then delivers it.
Yeah.
Kind of like, or not quite a double pump, because he's shaping to pass and he's just waiting and holding the ball for the perfect amount of time.
Yeah.
And Japan's try eventually comes, their first try, through Yoshinaga, isn't it?
I think it's the winger. I think it's Taomo Falau scores.
Oh, of course it is. Sorry, yeah. But he's in the.
But Yoshinaga gives the assist.
Which never happens there.
Yeah, it's impressive actually because
timing it perfect.
Yeah, they actually execute a 3-on-2 really nicely.
Yeah,
which we've not seen happen so far. Like, we've not really seen a 2-on-1 executed well so far. So a 3-on-2 it's very well orchestrated by Hirao, as you mentioned, and Yoshinaga times that last pass really well. And yeah, it gives Taomo Falau just enough time to dive into the corner, and it's technically quite a good finish. And I think this is actually, by today's standards.
Oh, sorry, I was thinking the second try. Sorry. Oh, okay. I got the two tries mixed up.
Yeah.
Yes.
But yeah,
yes, completely.
It's really well orchestrated by the Japanese kind of inside backs. And then, yeah, it's just a technically good finish on the wing. He does exactly what he needs to get the ball down. And yeah, no, it's impressive, as I say, especially by the standards of 87. It's one of the better tries we've seen so far with this tournament.
It's just a superb try. Hirao identifies the space, jogs into it, and times when to unleash the centres, when to unleash Yoshinaga to put down with Lau in.
Yeah.
Times it really well, orchestrates the thing really well.
Yeah.
Sorry, I led on to the second try there, which was the Yoshinaga.
That's okay. Hirao also, in the build-up, makes a nice break where he dummies past two men, arguably, he should have given the pass, but the men just fall for the dummy, even though they have him fully marked, because that sometimes happens at this point.
Everyone falls for every dummy in
this
game. There's one Hirao throws in the last 10 minutes.
It's like throwing dummies against 8-year-olds, isn't it?
Yeah. There's one he throws in the last 10 minutes where there's not even anyone he could be passed. Like, there's a winger right out on the touchline. He'd have to really wind up the pass in order to throw it. And he does a little, like, dummies a pop pass. And everyone falls for it. And he just glides through.
I love that. There's also a point where I realised, with Japan throwing all these offloads, it just made me think, I wonder who and when the lift pass was invented. Who invented that? Because Japan could have really done with that being a thing in this game. Because of, like, how late they would time a lot of their runs. And sometimes deliberately. But obviously it becomes telegraphed when you just pop it to them normally or do a little push pass. But whereas if you lift it to them, it's a lot harder to kind of, you know, occupy that space. I think Japan really could have benefited if that pass existed at this stage of rugby's development.
I mean, it was probably bloody Wayne Smith, wasn't it?
Probably was. That'll be an interesting thing to, as we go back through these World Cups, to realise kind of at what point these techniques will have evolved.
Yeah. Yeah, but speaking of things evolving, shortly after that first try, the USA regained the ball around the halfway line, and they string together a few really lovely offloads and passes and, like, sequences, you know, whipping the ball away. There's a moment where it's quite reminiscent of the try Monte Ioane scored at Twickenham last year.
Yes.
Where Lamoureux offloads off the floor, and it takes two men out of the game.
Quick phase,
And, you know, that kind of thing, and then they just draw the numbers down, except they get caught on the wing. And then, I think the USA run... the first 2-second ruck in the history of rugby, where all the forwards pile in, the ball is so quick, the scrum half just whips it away.
Mm.
And obviously they then get it at the other touchline, because the defence is not set. They're used to, any time there's a ruck, it takes 12 seconds, at which point the referee blows and they have to form a scrum. And instead, like, it's a 2-second ruck. It's properly, like, quick, efficient, and the ball is out.
Yeah.
It felt really noticeable. And
it's crazy the difference that makes, isn't it? I mean, it's not crazy. It makes sense entirely, considering the rucks were all about 10 seconds long at this stage.
Yeah.
Anyway, but this is in the lead-up to the Purcell try, isn't it?
Yeah, so they hang an up and under, I think.
Yes, yes, and Higgins becomes the first person to ever catch an up and under.
This is the moment that Higgins became my absolute hero, right? For one, I want Higgins and Adam Beard to start Ted Lasso 15.
Yes, yeah.
They can, you know, find that. I googled it. There's a guy called Charles Kent who played for England in like the 30s.
That'll do.
We need him, and we need someone called, like, I mean, Tart and Lasso are more difficult names.
Yeah, but... yeah. Sadly, there's not an Obasanya playing in the Premiership.
No. But, you know, one day we'll get them out. We'll find the rest of them.
Yeah.
But, right, so Buddy Higgins takes an up and under, progresses, tries to thread the pass through, and I think in the end just does well to get it away. Higgins, over the course of this game, became my hero. And I didn't know his first name until I looked at the team sheet. Before I started recording. And his name is Kevin, and that just... Kevin Higgins sounds like such an uninspiring middle management of a name.
It really does.
To say that
not a really flary outside centre for the USA, the plucky underdogs.
Who just, like, he has such a... Higgins looks like he actually trains hard.
Yeah.
Like, his core skills are really good.
Yeah.
He's a flair player, but his core skills are above the rest of that back.
Yeah, he's excellent.
I also meant to mention Gary Hine on the left wing.
Yeah.
Who is largely anonymous the entire game.
Yeah.
He is the grandson of a really early NFL legend.
Oh, really?
His granddad was, like, early days of the National Football League, really
right.
big star player.
Okay.
And then Gary Hine, his grandson, goes on to be anonymous for the USA in the Rugby World Cup.
I think that this is the first game where we don't have the father of a current international playing. Not that I can find, anyway. I've looked at a few like, oh yeah, Fujita, there's an international called Fujita. I've looked at a few like that, and just sadly there's nothing that I can find. So I might be wrong, I hope I am.
Okay.
But there's no dads of current internationals playing in this game.
That's a shame. That's a real shame.
Yeah, that's the first game where that's been the case of this World Cup.
I mean, it doesn't feel like... I mean, I'm assuming Fujita isn't related to Yoshi.
That's the thing, I've just looked that up. Sadly,
sorry, did you say that?
Yeah.
I was just reading about Gary Hine's grandfather, sorry.
That's okay. That's what I said when uni lecturers said, why are you falling asleep? I said, I'm not, I'm just looking at Gary Hine's grandfather.
I'm just looking at Gary Hine's grandfather.
Yeah.
Mel Hine, known by the nickname Old Indestructible.
That's a good name.
Two-time NFL champion. He was the season MVP in 1938. Eight-time first-team all-time pro. Four times he played in the All-Star Weekend, which rugby needs.
Yes.
Gary Hine in. The New York Giants retired the number 7 after him.
Oh, that's cool.
He was in the all-time team on the NFL's 100th anniversary.
That's cool.
He was a proper massive legend. And his grandson played... he won 25 caps for the USA.
Yeah, that's respectable, especially in this day and age.
Captained them in the sevens in 1993.
Oh, okay. So he was the Zach Test of his day.
He was the Zach Test of his day.
That's good. We need to get Blaine Scully to talk to us about why all of his players are amazing. Because no doubt he idolised these fellas. And
oh, of course.
With good reason.
Ray Nelson must have been some.
Oh, yeah. Must have been some guy for Blaine Scully to be a young fullback growing up in the USA. I think he was born in 1987 as well, come to think of it.
He went on to play against Japan in 2011 in a warm-up game for that World Cup.
Symmetry, man.
I think it was like his second cap.
Ah. Did he talk to us about that when we had him on this podcast? Which
Quite
you might
possibly.
Remember. Yeah.
But I was just looking up other games between Japan and the USA and saw Blaine Scully played in one.
I love Blaine Scully.
We do, of course, have Blaine Warhurst playing
this
game.
Yes,
because there has to be a Blaine at all times.
Yeah, Blaine Warhurst. Sounds like a Game of Thrones character.
He doesn't sound real at all. Blaine Warhurst.
I've not actually seen Game of Thrones, but I just think that's accurate.
Billy Kevin Sword sounds like a Game of Thrones character I'd make up.
No, that's entirely accurate as well.
It's bloody Kevin Sword, isn't it? And he's just going to visit the Ninky Nonk and the Tombly Boos. It's not in Game of Thrones. It's Kevin Sword going to visit the
Tombly Boos. But they are set in the same universe.
What?
Were you just referencing
the Rugby World Cup?
Yes, and Game of Thrones. I thought you were referencing like In the Night Guard or something like that with the Nonky Nook and the.
Wait, is that a different show?
I'm saying that In the Night Guard and Game of Thrones are set in the same universe.
I thought they were the same program.
No, it's a spin-off.
Oh, all this time I thought they were the same show.
Yeah, it's like Wallace and Gromit and Shaun the Sheep.
I was so
confused
why like half of the movie stars now come from that TV show on CBeebies.
Yeah. I don't know why I just heard you say Nonkyuk and thought that's something from In the Night Garden.
No, it is. Is it? I was naming things from In the Night Garden.
Yes!
But the joke was that they're the same show.
I shouldn't be proud that I know that.
No, you should. You should be very proud.
Only because of you, because you watched that relentlessly.
I don't know what that means. So,
and you're older than me.
The USA have Tony Ridnall on the bench.
That's a good story, man. That's a great story. He doesn't come on.
No.
Nor does anybody else on either sub's bench.
Mike Caldner certainly warms up when there's an injury in the last minute, but I don't know if he actually gods on or not. Because they cut to him and he's jogging on the touchline because someone's down injured.
Right.
And they throw up Mike Caldner. And then I don't know if he gets on.
Fair enough, I suppose. I'm just checking if... Because I've seen that there's a Hirose on the bench for Japan. I want to see if he's KG's dad. Doesn't look like he is. Never mind. As you were.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Right, let's go on. So yeah, Purcell scores that try in the corner. And immediately the commentator goes, it's a great try by USA. They won 5 rucks in a row. And that's what he puts it down to. He's like, oh, that's incredible play.
It's a different age, wasn't it?
Yeah.
A different age.
Then Nelson nails the touchline conversion as well.
Also around the same time, they refer to Mike Purcell as being one of the most experienced players in this USA team. He has 13 caps.
Oh, man. You kind of feel for them at that point, though, don't you?
Like, yeah.
You know, with bloody Nelson being a veteran at 5 caps and that as well. But yeah. But yeah, no, they score that try and, you know, it's quite well worked. And then Japan come back with the Yoshinaga try that you described earlier,
yes.
Where they have...
It's probably, like, this first half is real...
It's fun, isn't it?
One team scores, then the other team
scores. Yeah, yeah.
It's fun.
I love...
And also, I went into this game not knowing the score, not knowing who won.
Yeah.
And because there's no scoreboard, I had no idea who was winning as well.
Yes. Yeah. The throw up kind of every 15 minutes to remind you, but you'd forget in between. I particularly like the build up for this try where Japan clear the ball and the USA winger Hine, in fact, it is Gary Hine who collects it, tries to beat a few people. And then behind him, he has Saunders ready to ruck over him. And he also has about 15 Japanese players behind him. And he decides. This is a good time to offload the ball. And obviously, Saunders gets swamped and the entire Japanese team then just run away with it. They do a really nice quick tap as well, which I think was Fujita himself.
I don't know if it's the one you're talking about. There's one where Gary Hine is taking the ball from a kick.
Yeah.
And he's trying to counterattack.
Yeah.
I think it might be this moment.
Yeah.
Where he, as I said, all of the USA players are in front of him still. They haven't.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. It's just the one behind
him. As some players are jogging back, he goes to pop the ball forward. And then stops it just before it leaves his hands.
It's pretty...
Clearly having... And it makes more sense now knowing that he's got an NFL background.
Yeah.
Because he's clearly forgotten the forward pass rule.
That's phenomenal. I love that he's in the World Cup and he has to think, oh no, you can't pass forward. Never mind.
Yeah.
It's not just like second nature to him. There's a point where Vizard, playing 8 for the USA, gets nailed back so hard that he just surrenders the ball. And I've literally never seen that happen on a rugby field before, where he literally just passes the ball to the opposition because he's getting smashed back that hard, rather than trying to give it to one of his teammates or whatever. But it's just a way of like begging for mercy and saying like, no, just stop tackling me. You can have the ball. I've never seen that happen, let alone in an international.
I was saying about how it was harder to keep hold of possession in those days. Mostly because no one bloody wanted
it. Nobody cared. It was voluntary.
It's just aimless kicking as well. Like,
yeah.
At one point in the second half, Hirao puts in a lovely, like, what would be a very modern touch finder, like, splits the two players in the backfield and puts out to touch. Like, it would have been a 50-22 if it was.
Yes.
And it's a beautiful, like, very modern tactical kick.
Yeah.
And I think it's the only one we've seen all tournaments.
Yeah. Yeah, there's very few, isn't there?
Oh, what was kicking so aimless.
What was the name of that Italian 10 who did a 50-22? I've forgotten his name already.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, he was just class.
He was class when he wanted to be.
It was law of averages with him.
Yeah,
like,
it was.
If you kick that much ball, one of them will be kicked.
Yeah, absolutely. But yeah, so Yoshinaga scores that try and obviously misses the conversion.
Just, like, beautifully set up by Hirao.
Yeah.
Like, really gorgeous timing on it.
Yeah. Then, yeah, he missed the conversion because it was between the posts or just next to the post, so therefore it was very difficult. He had a James Hook-like quality to him, did Yoshinaga.
Yes.
God, the amount of really easy kicks he missed.
I mean, we'll get through this.
Yeah.
Like, we'll cover this end of the game. But
yeah.
Like,
Jesus. Then, straight away, the USA strike back again with Ray Nelson this time, who scores a try. And you know what? It's a great line, a great fullback's line by him, and great hands from Helu to set him up as well.
Yeah, I mean, he just picks the line perfectly. Like, he looks up, sees the Japanese defense drifting too hard, and he kind of splits it as they're drifting over to cover Mike Purcell. And frankly, why wouldn't you go out to cover Mike Purcell? Because he is the absolute danger man.
He's a danger man. If not danger mouse.
A danger man and danger mouse, danger animal of all kinds.
Yeah.
Mike Purcell, you know. He's now 70 years old and lives in Aya in Pennsylvania. And you know what? I think he'd still be incredibly dangerous.
I think so. In one way or another, he's dangerous, that man.
Yeah, he's a real, real danger. He retired after this World Cup. But I think it's mostly because the UN sanctioned him too dangerous.
Oh yeah.
And
I did hear about that.
It was getting much too stressful for the UN, you know, him travelling around the world and so on.
It happens.
And they went, Mike Purcell, look, you're so dangerous that if you just stayed in one place and plugged yourself into the mains once every 3 days, you could power all of Pennsylvania. You have so much dangerous energy that we can harness this into electricity and power an entire state. And so Mike Purcell went, okay, when I get back from Australia/New Zealand, depending on where the game's being played that day, I, Mike Purcell, the most dangerous man in the world, am going to plug myself into the mains every 3 days and stay in Pennsylvania for the rest of my life. And he has done that.
That's good to hear. The amount of times you'll hear, you know, like Dallin Stanford types refer to players as being like the Duracell bunny, they don't mean literally.
No, but Mike Purcell was.
Yeah.
Mike Purcell was so dangerous because he was basically radioactive, you know? Look, there's all kinds of cover-ups and conspiracy theories about what happened in Chernobyl. What actually happened is Mike Purcell had a wee. But yeah, Ray Nelson picks a good line.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about the bit about the rugby and the game that we're meant to be covering. I got too carried away from your story of Mike Purcell now living in...
True story.
Like,
true story. I did my research.
A factory. Or something in Pennsylvania. Yeah, no, it's good to hear you've done your research. And this is what good rugby punditry and coverage is all about. Is about knowing what Mike Purcell is currently doing.
It's like Clive Woodward's falling over all the time. That, and he's only got one leg now.
Yeah, yeah, he does.
Yeah, this was because he's falling over.
Yeah,
yeah. Mike Purcell. This is his penultimate cap. Sadly.
Oh, is it? That's a shame.
He plays one more game
before his batteries run out.
That's it.
Yeah.
Then he has to go home. He has to go home and be and power all
recharge
the entire state. Yeah.
Yeah.
They consider trying neighboring states with him, but it's a bit dangerous, you know.
So
ironic that he's more dangerous than Kevin Source.
Yeah, it is actually.
And
it is
Blaine Warhurst.
Yeah, that's true. There's some and Jeremy Clarkson.
And Jeremy Clarkson, who is of course the best 10 in the world.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Joe Clarkson's an interesting player. Can we talk about Joe Clarkson for a
minute? Yeah, go on then.
Because Joe Clarkson is an interesting fly half. Because he's a fly half who very much looks like a fly half. Like, he plays like a fly half. But I can't tell if he's any good or he just seems like a fly half. And that seems like a
rarity. I think he fancies himself. He can't kick.
Oh, he obviously does.
And he's, like, flanker weight. Like,
But he has this, like, nice... I don't know, I'll tell you what it is, right?
Yeah.
Joe Clarkson is very good at picking the times at which he should dummy and do a little dummy and shimmy, right? And that, to me, made him look like a fly half because only fly halves have the game awareness to throw dummies at this
point. Sure, yeah. I think he has fly half energy, and that's why he's playing fly half. Yes. I think nothing about him screams fly half, except his energy is that of a fly half. Therefore, he is the USA's national team's number 10.
I found him, I can't tell you if he's good or bad, but I found him a fascinating player to watch. And whenever he had the ball, I was like, it was hard to take my eyes off Joe Clarkson, the greatest 10 in the world.
Yes, yes. Also, so back to the Ray Nelson try. The other thing I like about this is that
it's amazing that nobody would have made that joke at the time.
Yeah. And now, probably...
Now it's just too obvious.
Every time he comes to the UK, he probably has people saying, oh, you like Jeremy Clarkson, aren't you? It's funny.
Do you think in the years to come, people will look back and because there's a, you know, at this point, like... In 2050, the equivalent of GOK 1 is called, like, Peter Emmerich. And they'll look back on the 2011 World Cup and be like, GOK 1's playing 13 for the USA.
Which he actually was in 1991, but we'll come on to that on a different podcast. So GOK 1 played for America.
He was, of course, this week on Celebrity Tipping Point, which, for anyone who isn't British, is a bizarre television program to try and explain. It's a quiz show. It's a bit like those games you see at arcades where you drop coins in the hope that it tips more coins off the edge. He was on Celebrity Tipping Point this week.
I didn't even know there was a celebrity version of Tipping Point.
Yep. One of the questions he was asked was, in 2018, Razzy Erasmus became the director of rugby of which national rugby team?
Oh, wait, you sent me that. I just didn't look up and go, that's GOK 1 being asked that question.
GOK 1 was asked this week about Razzy Erasmus, and he said New Zealand was his answer.
It's close.
Not geographically.
No.
So that's my little GOK 1.
Yeah.
Also, if you're not British, you don't know who GOK 1 is anyway.
Yeah, that's true. Do you know when he played for America in 1991 World Cup. What are you on about?
He played for America GOK in World Cup.
Do you know what position he played?
And he taught his team to look good naked.
Do you know what position he played?
Go on.
One.
Oh, because it was... Cool. So
anyway, this Ray Nelson try. The other thing is that he doesn't run it under the post, even though he's completely unopposed.
No.
If anything, he runs it further away, and then he nails the conversion anyway, so it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. It's massive Carlos Spencer
energy. Yeah. And then the USA go in 11-15 up. Yeah, it's Carlos Spencer energy, except he's not Carlos Spencer. He's bloody Ray Nelson, who might or might not be American.
Brian Vizard, towards the end of the first half as well, gets penalised for, instead of doing a handoff, he just swings his arm straight into the player's face.
So, yes.
Is he carrying the ball?
I was going to have... That was John Everett, the hooker.
Oh, I forgot. I thought it was Vizard.
Yeah.
Sorry.
So, yeah, I was going to talk about this. So he collects a ball in the backfield where, you know, because it's all disorganised. And I love his approach to counter-attacking, where he does a dummy kick past the first man and then sidesteps. And then he thinks, right, okay, I need to not go into touch here. What do they usually do? Handoff? And he just punches his man in the face.
He just swings his arm full force straight into the face.
Yeah, and then the referee just penalises him and goes, no, you can't do that. You're not meant to punch him. And I just love that approach to counter-attacking. And I just think that more modern fullbacks should do that. Imagine Freddie Stewart doing that.
Freddie Stewart should do that
against
Wales.
Yeah, he should.
Because we need more red cards this year.
Yeah, that's true. If he's got sausage to step, then he probably will.
Yeah.
Wynn Jones sausage, that is.
Yes. We also have, towards the end of the half as well, Japan take another penalty from just next to the post. It wasn't quite between it this time. And obviously they miss. The USA, from the dropout, I believe it's Joe Clarkson that goes to absolutely... And you can see him like put weight behind it and try and hit it as hard as he can. And it doesn't cross the 22.
And he really tried his hardest, didn't he?
He really tried.
Yeah. There's a few fun chips like that, mainly from Clarkson. There's one that Chida, the Japanese 8, does that goes completely sideways, which is a lot of fun.
The USA then take the scrum against the head, though, so it works out.
Mm. Yeah. And then they keep the ball in hand next time, so they've learned from their mistakes, which is enough. It's better than what England did in the game we watched for them against Australia, so it's worth something.
So we're getting to half-time.
Yes.
Right? So I want to throw up a stat from halftime.
Go on.
Right? The penalty count in that first half. So the USA were penalised 9 times, Japan once.
And yet USA were leading.
That tells you everything. Yep. Yeah.
And like, I usually do this thing where I count up what the score would have been if they'd got all the kicks. I didn't do that today because I just knew the score was close enough that even if all the kicks that they missed were worth half a point each, I know that Japan would have won the game.
So do you want a stat?
Go on.
Kind of spoilers, I guess. but no one listening to this cares.
The score is literally in the title of the podcast.
Yeah. If Japan got only the kicks that were between the posts that they missed, only the kicks that, like, an under-13s kicker could have made.
Sure, yeah.
Right? They would have won by 5 points.
That's significant enough as well, because a couple of them must have been conversions as well. Like, yeah.
Oh, conversions, 3 penalties, I believe.
That's...
Maybe 4 penalties.
That's ludicrous. I did that as well. They were 2 from 10 in the end, their goal kicking.
So they missed...
By the end of the game. So they missed 8 kicks.
They missed 13 points between the posts.
Bloody hell. That's...
So it's more than 5 points. Yeah, it's... Yeah. Because they only lost by 3 in the end.
Yeah. That's ridiculous. So USA wouldn't have got a losing bonus point if they existed at this point.
Yeah.
Look at me being on Michael Checker. That's a really staggering statistic. Basically, Japan were all right, just... And you know what? Yoshinaga was all right with ball in hand.
Yeah.
But kicking at goal, nah-uh.
Hirao was such a well-rounded footballer. Why couldn't he kick
goal? I was shocked by that,
to be
honest. Why
would he be at least third-choice kicker?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You'd...
And, like, Shogo Mackay, the fullback, who we haven't mentioned at all.
No.
Looked solid. Like, he was a really solid fullback.
You think?
Why?
We'll come on to him. We'll come on to him. Second half starts. Mm. Japan get a penalty on halfway and go for a bomb instead of going for touch, which I think is quite an interesting tactic.
See, okay, but there's a point later on, towards the end of the game, with about 10 minutes to go when they're obviously behind and they're looking for a try in order to get back level. And because you didn't get the line-out throw if you kicked into touch from a penalty, it was the opposition got the ball at the time. The commentator criticises them and says, with such short players and they're struggling so much on the line-out, they should just try and bomb the ball in the air from a penalty like this. From such good ball, they should just be bombing it in the air randomly.
So it's clearly an established tactic because no one can catch the ball. That's why I did think that's actually not a bad shout going for that. Because I was very shocked when Vizard actually caught that ball. And he caught it excellently under pressure as well. Like, and he managed to lay it back for his teammates and they managed to exit from there. And it was impressive. Because when they went for that, I kind of actually thought, oh, that's actually kind of smart. You see a lot of teams do it for free kicks these days.
Yeah.
But not from a full penalty because you just think territory, you know, will chance the line out. But yeah, no, it's quite interesting at this point because everybody's been dropping the ball so far in the tournament. So fair play to them for giving that a go.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. The only thing I've got written from this kind of like start of the half bit for me is, guys, Higgins is class. And, oh no, so he does a support run, catches up after this is actually in the lead up to the try by Mike Purcell, the most dangerous man in the world.
Okay, yeah.
Which I think is, no, it's the end of the first
half. That's the one in the first half, yeah.
The end of the first half, sorry. Okay, no, I've got that mixed up, but I just have that he is absolute class, and also there's a really terrible tackle attempt by Onuki, who is not bothered.
No.
It's like watching Matt Provero being invented. Although Onuki does make an absolute shot towards the end of the first half as well. He nails his man. I think it is Purcell.
I think it is, where he invents the Hurt Arena.
Yes. What if Matt Provero ran the Hurt Arena?
I love it though, because like he does that, and Purcell drops the ball as a result because of line speed and pressure. And then the next time Onuki gets the ball, Purcell does exactly the same thing back to him. And he's like, oh, that's quite a good tactic. Do you mind if I borrow that? And he gives it a go and it works.
Yeah.
And Onuki, every time he gets the ball, either drops it or just steps around everybody. It's great.
Did you watch the halftime punditry?
Yes, but...
With Korg and Murray Mekstad.
I'll level with you. I was watching Peep Show at the same time.
It's almost as farcical. Korg, the Taika Waititi character, refers to the Mike Purcell try as having come from a superb attack when it's literally a speculative bomb.
Oh, man. You got to love the 1987 punditry, haven't you?
It was a superb attack, though.
Yeah. We're probably, in terms of our timeline, in terms of from a storytelling perspective, we're about 10 minutes into the second half, right? 10, 15 minutes is where we're at, timeline-wise. Then,
Are we thinking the same thing?
When Japan opt for goal.
Oh, no, okay.
And the commentators say, I think he's wise to do that. And you know what? It paid off because they actually got the kick.
Yeah.
But I was just thinking, like, why on earth would you do that? But that was when they changed kicker and... the USA went into the lead. Next is the thing that you're thinking of.
Yes. So, How do we best describe this?
Well, I've got it written down as well. Mukai Dick of the Day is wrapped up.
Oh, no, that's not the thing I'm thinking of.
Okay, what's the thing you're thinking of?
I mean, no, the thing you're thinking of is pretty golden. As you say, Dick of the Day is Mac, and you've attributed it to the wrong man, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, have I?
But, yeah, that I know what you're talking about. What I'm talking about is mid-sentence, the commentator stops talking, right? There's a stoppage in play. Did you get this? Did you see this?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Do you skip over stoppages and stuff?
No.
No. There's a moment, mid-sentence.
But you where... know, this was probably the point where Jeremy forgot the turkey.
It's a Christmas joke.
Yeah. No, it was actually the episode where they have the house party and those people turn up and Nick marks lasagna. Anyway, carry on.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good episode.
Good on. Yeah, yeah. So, the commentators are mid-sentence when one of them stops talking. And then we just hear a baby cry. Oh, they're saying toddler crying.
What?
It sounds like a 2 or 3-year-old, not a baby. Just sort of like crying or laughing somewhere in the middle.
I missed and then
there's
this!
There's another voice sort of shouting alongside, like, kind of like, ah! Like an adult voice, like a woman's voice. Who I assume is their mother. And then they say something along the lines, and I've got it written down, of the woman's voice, and it says, all right, we'll do it the hard way. And then there's sort of this shouting, the child shouting continues for a few seconds. And then there's just silence on the commentary for about 40 seconds. I think I timed it. It's like 38 seconds of silence in which nothing is said. At which point, the commentator then says, well, of course, their forward structure has been very interesting so far.
You see, so the thing is,
they changed the wrong audio track.
Yeah.
Or a toddler broke into the commentary booth and started shouting over the microphone.
Oh, it would do
and
it
then
the
mother
hard,
had
eh?
to come and remove them.
Thing is, I don't recall this, but it rings a bell, which makes me think I probably did actually hear this.
Yeah.
But I just filtered it to the back of my mind because I'm so used to just the 80s being nuts when watching these games yeah. back. But clearly, like, my brain has compartmentalized that just utter madness that's happening in the broadcasting of these games.
Well, because I was eating my tea whilst watching this game yesterday.
Okay, this wasn't during halftime, this was during the actual game.
During the game, okay. There's a stoppage in play. Like, there was someone
I finished watching Peep Show at this point, so this had, this was...
Someone was down injured. Like,
so I saw
this happened during it.
Yeah.
I presume so. Unless you skipped over the injury.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless you kind of skipped forward during it. Yeah, I was icing my tea and I kind of looked down. And as I looked back up, well, no, I kind of like jolted back up and I just heard a baby start crying.
Oh my God.
Over the commentary instead of these kind of very placid Kiwi men.
I just did not register that. That's.
I don't know what happened. I don't know what, how, or why that happened.
What if that baby was playing Scully?
Oh my God.
He would have been 3 months old at this point.
And they were crying because they just saw Mike Purcell, the most dangerous man in the world.
Yes. And then had a realisation, that has to be me one day. I have to play in that 14 shirt for the USA. Or I have to be the next Ray Nelson!
Because that's more inspirational.
Yes. Yeah. Than just being dangerous. Wanting to be a Scottish person who's not good enough to play for Scotland, so pretend they're American instead.
Slightly like Matt McKnight. Do you think that's his qualification?
Yeah. I look like this like cool American guy who's not born yet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Presumably.
Yeah.
Yes. So we then have, and it is shortly after the baby screaming and crying.
Mm.
I think it actually might be the reset of the game. A scrum pretty much on halfway for the USA.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And the ball goes into the scrum. Looks like a pretty normal scrum when Brian Vizard picks up the ball at number 8. And the Japanese 9, Ikuta, goes like he. It's one of those, right? Where he goes to tackle Mike Saunders, his opposite number. But he's not doing it. He's not marking him because he thinks he's getting the ball. He's marking him because he's an easier tackle if he does get the ball.
He chooses not to tackle Vizard.
He
does it as a scapegoat. He does it so he can go, oh no, sorry, I was just marking him because he's smaller.
Right, I think that is actually more encouraging than Hirao, who doesn't move. When you watch this back, and I did rewind it to watch it again, Hirao stands still. And look, I thought Herrera was magical with the ball in play.
Yeah.
But he doesn't seem to function or move when the ball is not going into his hands.
You know when on rugby games when you get a glitch and somebody's rooted to the spot?
Yes.
He was that.
He feels like a session fly half.
Yeah,
like
you
bring him in for your attack, and then he's just kind of not present for the rest because he's not being paid for that.
Like, that was maybe it. Like, he'd agreed to come from Richmond to play this World Cup on the condition that they didn't want him to make tackles.
Yeah.
And then the coach starts having a go with him and goes, no, I'm doing you a favour here. I'm one of your best players.
So Bill Nighy infamously signed on to the film About Time on the condition he didn't have to do any acting.
Right.
And
that's very much the vibe of Herrera.
That's the vibe. It's like, look, I'll do this, but I'm not doing any of the hard bits.
No. Yeah,
I will be myself. I will not do any acting.
Sure.
I will not do any tackling. I will not do any defending. I will not kick the goals. That is an imposition on me. Don't you know who I am? I play for Richmond. Yeah. I should be in the Ted Lasso
on his his contract. Where he's got it written down, like, name, Seiji Herrera. Position, dummy thrower.
Yes.
What do you bring to this team? I am the thrower of dummies.
I will time one pass beautifully per half.
Yeah.
I will look like an absolute magician if Ruddy Dart is making a highlights compilation.
Oh, man. Yeah.
So, he avoids the tackle, and Vizard storms on through, right past halfway, past the 10-metre line. He eats up about 30 metres in this run. And it's not like a typical number 8 run where he busts tackles and he carries people on his back. He just runs into open water.
Yeah.
At which point, Mackay, the fullback, comes in to try and make the tackle. And he throws the most speculative offload you'll see until Japan next get the ball.
Yeah. And it actually works. He offloads to Gary Lambert, doesn't he? Is it Gary Lambert he gets?
No, it's Blaine Watchhurst.
Oh, yeah. Warhurst. Yes, but it's his foot, isn't it?
Yeah. So it connects. The ball lands on Warhurst's foot, who just kicks the ball on. And it's not a beautiful touch like Fujita did in the first half. Like, he just hammers it as far as he can. And the ball bounces towards about the 10-metre line. At which point, Telma Falau is tracking back. And
He kicks it into his own in-goal area.
He kicks it into his own in-goal area.
And I have no idea why.
It doesn't look like an accident.
It doesn't look like... Because sometimes it's the correct option to just boot the ball into touch. Again, if in doubt, kick it out.
Sure.
Sometimes it's the correct call to do that and just get it off the park, reset, have a set piece, whatever. But it doesn't look like he's even doing that. And I don't know if it's just that he connects badly with the ball, but he also has enough time that he could pick it up and kick it out. Or that he could pick it up and try and run a little bit. But instead, he just kicks it into his own in-goal area without having picked it up. And who should be perfectly positioned inside that in-goal area? But it's not Purcell, is it? It's Lambert. It's Lambert who scores the try, isn't it?
No. It's
Warhurst. Warhurst. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, I'm just watching it back, and he does it absolutely... I've got the clip back up.
Okay.
He does it absolutely deliberately. I'll tell you what he's doing. I'm watching it back, like, frame by frame.
Yeah.
He's trying to boot the ball over the touchline. He tries to hit it with the side of his foot to kick it over the touchline. He then looks surprised when the ball ricochets into the dead
when
ball
he
line.
Doesn't manage to pull off this incredibly cultured skill.
Because it's about 10 metres in field.
Right, like,
Also, there's two USA players haring down on him. Like, it is a difficult thing for him to put that ball out.
Yeah.
He's definitely going to kick to the touchline.
Okay.
He just has a really
He could have just picked it up and taken it behind his own goal line, though.
But the thing is, right, bloody Gary Hayne, the grandson of
whoever the
Tom
hell it is,
Daly,
the unstoppable machine or whatever his name was.
Yeah, is absolutely haring down. He's right by the touchline there. Next to him, so he'd probably kick it straight to Hayne.
Yeah.
But instead, he kicks it over his dead ball line where Warhurst just dives on.
And the USA score, I guess, goes on to become the winning try.
Yeah, Warhurst just absolutely delighted and just throws his arms in the air and, like, understandable massive celebration.
Yeah. So I actually attributed, when I said Dick of the Day is wrapped up, I did attribute it to the wrong man, you're absolutely right. But... yeah, I feel like it's quite a few... Basically, all of these 1987 episodes, I've basically given away Dick of the Day votes early, but there's more contenders, so it's not wrapped up just yet.
There are loads of contenders.
Yeah, yeah. Because it is a 1987 rugby match.
Yes.
Nelson gets a conversion again, right out on the touchline. Yeah. 21-14 to the USA now.
Bounces off the crossbar.
Yeah. It's delightful.
Off the crossbar over.
The touch judges look delighted.
The touch judges look at each other like, we've just seen some shit.
Yeah, yeah.
This was good.
So, speaking of world firsts, like you said earlier about world first, bit of line speed, you know, clever kick and whatever else. The world's earliest 50-22 save comes in here. When,
yes.
I'm not sure entirely who it is. I think it's Nelson goes for a 50-22.
I think it's Purcell.
Purcell goes for a 50-22. And then Hirao blocks it from going into touch, like it actually would have been the opposition's throw-in. I just think that's incredible. Like, that's 30 years ahead of your time you've done that.
He is a player ahead of his time, and he spends the time he should be defending reading up on the future of rugby.
Yes, yeah. So yeah, that was a fun thing. Yeah, then there's Vizard getting nailed and surrendering the ball and just throwing it straight to Japan.
Onuki struggles an incredible amount with one high ball where he drops it behind him. He then fumbles it again, kicks it backwards, which, you know, was the trend amongst Japanese wingers at the time.
All wingers
fumbles
at the time.
It on the floor, regathers it right as Mike Purcell gets right up in his face and offloads it to Mackay, who finds a really good touch finder. To his credit.
I do love all of the really accidental, incredible stuff that goes on in this whole World Cup so far, to be fair.
Mackay has a vibe of, if he was from any other nation, he'd be going, oh, for God's sake, the whole time.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But
yeah.
Instead, he's just very calmly going about his work.
Sure, yeah.
He's got this kind of, like, real workman energy about him.
Yeah. No, I get it. There's a good accidental break Yoshinaga makes, where they give him the ball off a scrum, and then it's meant to be this intricate move where everyone's running different lines off him, and all of them somehow manage to mistime it, like, in different ways, and then he just kind of dummies to all of them, runs backwards, and steps, like, four people, and accidentally makes a break into the USA 22. I don't think it actually results in anything. I think it maybe results in them missing a shot at goal.
Yeah, I think they missed a shot at goal from a penalty for it.
Yeah, but
which is what happened pretty much every time they got the ball.
Yeah.
There's another really lovely move they run.
Yeah.
Where they interlink, like, from one touchline to the other, and it gets up to Hirao on the far touchline.
They use a dummy runner. It's great.
Yeah. Oh, there's a couple of them.
Yeah.
Dummy runner klaxon. There's a long thing in the history of Japanese rugby of, like, set piece moves, like designed back moves, being a huge part of their rugby culture.
Yeah.
And a huge thing that, like, practiced and learnt and so on.
Yeah.
In a way that the rest of the world kind of caught up to. And, like, they weren't necessarily invented in Japan, but, like, they weren't even necessarily popularised by Japan.
Yeah.
But it was just such a huge part of how they played the game. It was viewed as, like, essential to their style of rugby.
Yeah.
And there's a few of those. And there's one where they run a move like that looks lovely. They get it to one touchline, then they recycle it over to the other, which is very reminiscent of how they would go on to play under Eddie Jones. There's a few moments like that, and I think it's that one where it then gets out to Hirao on the touchline, who takes an offload off another player. And he goes to Fred through like a no-look grubber for himself to chase, which was something Utamura did against Ireland, which resulted in a try for one of the wingers, and I forget who it was, this summer in June.
Yeah.
And he goes to do that, but it's blocked by Ray Nelson, because what a legend. And he just hoofs the ball into touch. But I think with a lesser fullback, that would have been a really gorgeous skill.
Yeah. No, it's interesting stuff like that happened. There's, of course, the Miyamoto disallowed try. Miyamoto was quite fun, by the way.
I enjoyed Miyamoto, number six.
He liked kicking the ball a lot as well. And
yes.
You know,
he was just
flashy.
Sort of everywhere. Yeah. He's incredibly energetic as a player.
I enjoyed him.
He just really put himself about, carried a lot. Wasn't the biggest guy, but just really threw himself into everything.
Yeah. But, yeah, he had a try disallowed in the last sort of 5 minutes or so, where he really, like, outstretched. And it looked like a try in real time, but the referee called it spot on, that he did knock it on just in the lead-up to the grounding. And USA sort of exit, but...
Well, there's a...
Yeah.
This goes on for quite a while, these kind of last 10 minutes, where Japan are on the USA line and a try puts them back in it. A try puts them 3 points behind. Oh, no, sorry, a converted try will put them 1 point behind.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously they're not assuming that. And they... Now, really great defence in 1987 looks like a succession of flukes. So I can't work out if the USA were defending incredibly well or getting incredibly lucky or Japan were blowing chance after chance.
Yeah. A bit of all of the above, I think.
Yeah, because the USA hold them out for about 7 or 8 minutes.
Yeah.
And they're constantly given scrum fives and so on, and the USA get a scrum five, but they can't. I mean, Joe Clarkson does really well behind his own goal line under lots of pressure to clear the ball up to about, you know, 15 metres out.
Mm-hmm.
But Japan are constantly attacking, constantly there, and they're constantly not quite scoring. You know, they have one held up, they have one, as you mentioned, Miyamoto tries disallowed. And then eventually, one of the scrum fives, it all just clicks, and they just drive the ball over.
You say they drive it over?
Yes.
It's interesting, I mean, what happens. So it's Taumafalau scores the try again, isn't it?
No, it's... But, oh, no, okay, it is Waterman.
Yeah.
I thought it was the scrum half. I thought it was Ikeda.
No. It was the winger.
Yeah, it's the him.
So, because wingers were allowed to be offside at this point. So the ball comes loose, but so it's technically...
They're driving the ball. It looks like it's going to be a pushover try.
Yeah.
The ball spills out.
Yes, on the right-hand side of the scrum. So towards technically, it's a kick assist by Shida.
Yes.
Because it squirts out from his right boot, accidentally kicks it forward, and it comes out
Shida's
of the scrum. And Taumafalau just dives on it. I say he dives on it, he kind of gets a fingertip on it.
He kind of, yeah, there's like a fingertip on one part of the ball and it fumbles forward.
Yeah.
So TMO now, it'd be down to TMO's interpretation nowadays.
Yeah,
it's a really
yeah.
tight one.
But I think it's a try.
At the time it was just given.
Yeah.
Who cares?
Yeah, exactly.
Know?
I think
it's
correct.
More of a try than the David Campese one.
Yes.
So.
Yes, very true. So that turns out to be the last play of the game because obviously they missed the conversion and are 2 from 10, as I say. So the final score is United States of America 21, Japan 18.
Yeah, which I think is probably a fair reflection.
Yeah.
I think Japan looked the better team, but uh-huh. when you're missing 8 shots at goal, you can't kind of justify literally anything.
No. You can't be like, oh yeah, we deserve to win that, lads. Yeah, I think the USA did deserve to win. But the best part of this entire game comes after the final whistle. Because the very last thing before the coverage ends, have you got a recording of this?
Or... No, but I have got this written down.
Yes, I have this written down.
It cuts back to the guy in the studio, the presenter, who has such a smug look on his face, like, God, he's just turned to Taika Waititi and Murray Meckstead and gone, guys, I've got the best line
yeah.
ever.
It's like, an accidental partridge.
Are you ready?
No.
I'm gonna give you the best line you've ever heard. It's gonna be so good.
I say accidental partridge. Alan Partridge didn't exist really at this point. It's a deliberate partridge, isn't it? So he says, at Ballymore and Brisbane there, the dollar too strong for the yen.
He's got a look on his face like he's so proud of himself for coming up with that.
What I love about it is that the coverage just stops there.
Yeah, that's
that the video finishes and there's nothing more. They had to leave in that one line and then that's it. That's it done. They could have not gone back to the studio.
No, it then... But it then, I imagine,
you could have
when they
down
go,
early.
Great, we're off air, and then it cuts in and Korg turns around and like, yeah, great line, bro. Yeah, I thought that was a really funny one because the dollar beats the yen.
Then that kid from earlier comes in and goes, what do you mean the dollar beats the yen? What does that mean? Because it's a kid.
Oh, yeah, the poor child.
Yeah.
I want to find that to put that on the end of the podcast or something. That was an extraordinary moment.
Okay, yeah.
Okay, have we covered most of the game?
I think we've covered all of the game.
Cool. I mean, we haven't really talked about Kevin Higgins, which is a shame.
No, but
I thought he was class.
There's more content for him to come, you'd imagine.
Yeah, real, like, burst of pace. Had good hands, really good under the high ball, especially say he wasn't even a fullback.
Yeah. Well,
really,
do you want to do
really
Man of the Match?
Generally by Kevin Higgins. Yeah, which I think leads us on to Man of the Match.
Yeah.
So I thought Kevin Higgins, who's a 13 for the USA.
I wrote him down as Man
well.
Of the Match,
like,
as a contender.
He is one of kind of two standout contenders for me, I think.
Yeah.
Well, no, three, I guess. Because Ray Nelson, I think, is...
Yeah, he's good.
He's very good. Solid, yeah. But I think makes quite a lot of mistakes along the way.
Yeah, of course he does.
I enjoyed Miyamoto. I think Fujita actually has a good game as well.
Yeah. He was good.
I enjoyed him. And I think Hayashi actually is kind of everywhere. He keeps popping up, the Japanese captain.
Yeah.
But my man of the match could not be anyone but the session magician himself, Saige Harao, who is, I think, by quite some distance...
He's excellent.
Anything you would want to put on like a highlights package, you'd want to put on like a, this is the best stuff that happened at the 1987 World Cup that happens in this game, is entirely down to him.
Sure.
He is the player who stands out, and he is, I think, about...
He throws
eight,
dummies.
He can't kick any points. Yeah. I think all three of Japan's tries are actually the position for the last one, but not the try itself.
Yeah.
Comes from him.
Yeah.
He is crucial to everything Japan do well. And for me, yeah, Soji Harao is the man of the match.
Excellent. For me, as I said, I wrote down Kevin Higgins, but my man of the match is Ray Nelson.
Nice.
If you're good enough to get a positive Ruddy Data review, then you deserve man of the match from Will Owen. So he scores a try. Does. He gets his kicks. He does a lot of crap along the way, don't get me wrong. But, you know, he puts in a lot of good kicks. And I think that he had the biggest positive impact for this USA team, for me personally. So yeah. I'm going with Nelson as my man of the match. So we're going to go into Dick of the Day in a second.
Yes.
However, anybody who follows me on Twitter who's listening to this may remember that about a month ago, I promised a story on this podcast.
Oh, of course.
So I am kind of a reigning Dick of the Day. So we always do Man of the Match Dick of the Day at the end of this. So it was the second to last match I played. At the time when I tweeted this, that was on the day that I played. But I recently played in a friendly match for my team, Long Eaton. A second team match, you know, because I'm not good enough to be in the first team. And I got Dick of the Day for that match for opposing rugby values. And yes, that's what I was told off for. And I got done for this in Kangaroo Court a month later for opposing rugby values. And this podcast was actually brought up on that by friend of the pod, Ryan Holden, who listens to this, listens to every episode. And hi, Ryan. Thanks for this. But he mentioned the podcast. He mentioned that I should know better. Because what happened was I was looking at, we had a centre or winger playing at fly half, doesn't usually play there, who was kicking the goals. So he didn't have a kicking tee. I had just a cone that I was bringing onto the field that he could kick off. And, you know, somebody holds it on there and he kicks it over. And you know what? He was doing an excellent job. And then my under-15s fly half turned up, who brings his kick just to watch the game, not to play. Yeah. But he brings his kicking tee absolutely everywhere with him. And I went, you know what? Have you got your kicking tee on you? Took the kicking tee from him. And he said, yeah, that's fine. You can use it. That's fine. I'm getting the kicking tee. And our 10 on the day was still nailing everything. And it was great. We were about 30 to 40 points up as half-time struck. First play of the second half, opposition scored. Mm. So the score was now probably about 31-5, I think it was. And then the opposition kicker then turns to me and goes, oh, can I borrow your tee? And I go, no. And then they've got their hooker there as well, who was being a knob all day, and saying, oh, come on, mate, give us your tee, you know, it's only fair. And I go, no, get your own. And so mine's all the way over there. I was like, go over there and get it then. At which point all of my teammates were heckling me and saying, like, oh, come on, just give them the tee, don't be a dick. You know, we're 30 points up, it's a friendly. And I was just thinking, no, they should bring their own tee. And yeah, got done for it afterwards. Opposed rugby values.
I do appreciate how literal an interpretation of Dick of the Day that is.
Yeah. Usually it's just given to somebody who does something stupid, but yeah. I kind of was being a dick there.
You kind of were being a dick. I understand it and respect it.
Yeah.
If you're playing in the World Cup.
Yeah. I also kind of forgot it was a friendly, but I think that's a good thing, right? Sure, you never treat it as a friendly.
Hey, there's no friendlies in rugby.
Exactly.
No friendlies in rugby. There's only values.
Yeah. Precisely. But yeah, I oppose rugby values, got Dick of the Day for not surrendering a kicking tee which wasn't even mine.
That kicking tee is just so different.
Yeah, it is. It's a very good kicking tee, actually. I've, you know, that the 14-year-old kid who kicks with it has a 78% kicking percentage so far this season. So,
which is better than Owen Farrell.
Yeah. Anyway, should we do Dick of the Day?
Sure, yeah. It's you.
Yes, it's me. So I've kind of already given it away that I'm going to give it to Tamo Falau for giving away that try at the end. Yes. Also, I've nominated Yoshinaga for missing about a dozen kicks.
Yep.
Everett for throwing that punch on the counter-attack was just a lot of fun. Ray Nelson for his grubber into touch was also a lot of fun. I think that's my selection of Dick of the Days.
One other contender I have that you have mentioned. Obviously, Yoshinaga, I think, deserves a bigger mention for missing four shots between the posts.
Yeah, and a couple more as well.
And not even looking that bad about it. Like, normally when you see kickers missing like that, they look really gut of themselves.
Yeah.
Remember that Carlo Canna almost crying after missing the shot at goal?
Yeah.
Playing for Italy in situations. Yeah. That kind of thing. They always look gutted with themselves or annoyed with themselves.
Yeah.
He was just like...
Did not care. Didn't want to do any better than he already was.
But his opposite number, Kevin Higgins, my hero, at one point is the miss pass goes to him off a scrum and he just drops the ball under no pressure. And I wrote in my notes, Om Higgins, why would you betray me?
Yeah, and that's valid.
And that treachery, betraying me when I thought he was the only person in 1967 who could catch, was a moment of disappointment. But it's not quite as big as Tamo Falau knocking the ball backwards into his own in-goal area and just gifting Blaine Warhurst a try. Just
so that's two votes for Tamo Falau, right?
2 votes for Tam of Lao.
Wow. That's does that maybe put him in the lead? I can't remember if we've given everyone else 2 votes.
Mate, have you already forgotten about Serafino Gazzoni?
Oh, yeah. Oh, man. How could I? What
the
player?
Legendary Italian fullback.
So, ironically, this week's really crap fullback is actually a winger.
Yep. So, currently leading the stakes, Dick of the Day, we have a joint between Taumafalau and Grisoni.
Yeah.
But the leaders on Man of the Match is a draw between Serge Blanco and Fabio the Dog.
That's excellent. That's brilliant. Especially because I'm pretty sure on the Christmas episode, at least one of us gave Man of the Match to
a dog,
didn't we?
I didn't count.
No. I'm not saying you should. But I think at least one of us gave Man of the Match to a dog on that. So, you know, if it comes down to a tie break, then sure, I reckon the dog takes it. That's my point. Forget the guy representing the human race and all the humans were given Man of the Match. Forget that.
Really, I think humanity is the real winner. It's somewhere between humanity and
rugby. Or dog manity. Am I right, lads?
But look, if only. So, I think that brings us through the end of.
How are all of our episodes an hour and a half plus now? We've got nothing to talk about yet.
There's a lot to talk about. Yeah. There's a lot to cover. Look, yeah. There's a lot of knock-ons we've got to discuss in detail.
Very true.
Sorry it's been so long since the last one.
Yeah.
It's excellent to be back.
It is.
And we will be back next week where the game in question will be Canada against Tonga.
That sounds like a fun one. I'm aware that beforehand we've maybe slightly messed up the order of these because we've just played whatever order games are on that day. But we will get the order correct from now on. And I'm very excited for us to be back and to still be doing this. I'm aware we say this a lot, but yeah.
Yeah. Okay. We'll see you next week to see Canada and Tonga's first ever Rugby World Cup matches. We, of course, covered that game in 2011. So I believe it's the first game where we've had a direct analogue.
Yeah, that's fun.
From 2011 to 1987. Yeah. So that's a fun thing.
It is.
That's a fun thing.
It is.
We'll be doing that very soon in the future, and I will learn to stop talking like I'm in House of Gucci, and I'll see you after that.
Okay. Goodbye.
All right. See ya.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.